From the Sky News Centre at 5. One of the killers of toddler James Bulger has been charged over indecent images of children. 35-year-old John Venables, who has a new identity, was recalled to prison in November and will go on trial at an undisclosed location. The chairman of the parole boards apologised to victims of rapist John Warboys after they were not told of his imminent release from prison. Nick Hardwick will also face questions from MPs over the decision to allow him to be freed on licence. The author of a controversial book on the Trump administration has laughed off claims from the president that it's full of lies. Donald Trump's rejected accusations in the book that he's unstable and his administration is in chaos. Speaking to NBC's Today programme, Michael Wolff insists many White House staff think he isn't up to the job.
They say he's a moron, an idiot. This man does not read, does not listen. It's like a pinball, just shooting off the sides.
A man who killed three former partners has been sentenced to at least 26 years behind bars. Theodore Johnson beat and throttled his ex-girlfriend Angela Best after she met another man. That's the latest. I'm Charlie Banks.
Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's first 2018 politics show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping us review this week's news is Labour Councillor for St George Troopers Hill, Fabian Breckles, along with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. After the 6 o'clock news, Libya, Syria, Ukraine, so why not Iran? Now, ISIS has been defeated by the Russians. Are the fighters being redeployed to Iran? 13 demonstrators killed, as well as 3 Iranian police wounded and 1 shot dead, as so-called peaceful demonstrators attack army barracks, police stations and town halls across the Persian capital and other parts of Iran. If violent demonstrators were to attack police and army in Britain, how would we react? And Yemen's Houthis, having killed their supposed ally, President Saleh, go on to seize bank accounts of over 1,200 Yemeni officials. And for weeks now, protests on the streets of Tel Aviv and other Israeli cities against corruption and bribery in the Israeli government of Benjamin Netanyahu. Almost unreported here in the UK news, but what is Netanyahu accused of? Ibrahim Abu Turaya is an unarmed Palestinian paraplegic protester shot dead by the IDF. Someone completely different who slipped away to his final judgment over the holiday, infamous US serial killer from the Process Church of the Final Judgment, Charles Manson. Anton Chatkin explains Manson's malevolent monks may have originated here in the UK. And another passing, this time of a good guy, Martin Summers' favourite Italian judge, Ferdinando Imposimato. Plus Martin's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 3 Celsius and some showers. This weekend, highs around 7, cloudy and windy tomorrow, sunnier but colder on Sunday. Next week, highs around 7 still, sunny spells and showers, some of them heavy. Next weekend, that's the 13th and 14th of January, highs of 7 Celsius, all about pretty much staying the same, isn't it? Sunny spells and heavy showers, though. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Looks like the only safe day, if I can say that, to go out is on Sunday, this Sunday. In a couple of days. So, joining me now is Fabian Breckles from St George Troopers Hill Labour Council. Hi, Fabian. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
One of the first things I'd like to ask you about is the news this just over the holiday that the Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti, is going to call his son Brexit. He was actually born during the vote on Article 50. Do you think we're becoming a bit too obsessed? Is it actually a good idea to call someone Brexit? Because what do you make of this, Fabian?
I think it always makes sense to give kids reasonably sensible names because they have to live with it afterwards. And he might think, you know, I mean, how's this kid going to get on in school, you know, when he's 10 or 15, when, you know, and he's called Brexit? I mean, he'll probably be... It's probably a license to be bullied. I mean, the Americans have done things like naming kids Apple and stuff like that. It's a bit, you know, just give the kid a sensible name.
What about Star Child? There's quite a few of those around in Somerset, aren't there?
Yeah, that's a bit new age, isn't it? No, just give a kid a normal name. They've got to live with it.
Martin?
I think, well, I mean, there's actually, I've worked in primary schools over the last few years. There's not the same fuss about funny names that there used to be, because you've got all sorts of people from all over the country, all over the world, and people do actually use, ordinary people now use, you know, David Beckham has got a lot to answer for in sort of calling his children various names. But I think calling them a political thing like Brexit is a bit, I mean, what happens if he grows up and he's not in favour of Brexit, for example? That's a bit, it's imposing too much on a child, that is.
That is a no-brainer, isn't it? That one. I mean, how can, yeah, so he becomes an enthusiast for Brussels when he gets to the age of five.
It's probably guaranteed that he will be.
He's going to change his name, isn't he? On a more serious note, we've got a cutting of free school meals. It looks as if 5,000 Bristol children could have free school meals taken away under new government plans. This is in the Bristol Post. Department for Education is consulting on changes to the provision of free school meals. There are more than 5,000 kids at risk of losing free school meals. A warning comes from Bristol East MP Kerry McCarthy, who's joined the Children's Society campaign against the changes, which could be brought in alongside the rollout of universal credit. The provision of free school meals can make a marked difference to children's education and health in alleviating persistent child poverty levels in our society, she said. This, again, another sounds like a no brainer. What those free school meals are there for a purpose, Fabian, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I just think it's just another Tory attack on the poorest and most vulnerable, and this time it's attacking the kids by starving them. I actually think that the government should fund free school meals for all kids. That gets rid of the stigma, because if you've got, you know, a school where a lot of kids are paying for their meals and others are having free vouchers or whatever, there's a stigma involved. Whereas if you have universal free school meals, you can recover it through progressive taxation. And there's no stigma involved, and you guarantee that kids from the poorest backgrounds get at least one decent meal a day. I just think it's deplorable. I think universal credit is all about making poor people even poorer and more vulnerable. When's it going to stop?
Well, who knows? I can remember as a child going to school. I think it was 60p school. I mean, that was, I suppose, it's the sort of figure that most people could get together. Now, Martin, obviously it's more.
It is, and the other thing I'd say about this is that if you remember, they brought in free school meals, a coalition for infant school pupils, and then they've taken that. That meant that schools had to create a whole infrastructure which had disappeared for providing meals, and then you start cutting it back. That's a false way to proceed. I agree with Fabian. It makes lots of sense to provide free school meals for everybody, and to provide the infrastructure for that. And that, of course, is got health benefits apart from anything else.
Yeah.
I can remember when we were at school, we used to have to sit down in secondary school, and we had to have a proper meal. There was one sixth former, one fifth former, and we were all forms had to sit there, and we had to have like a family meal, with the sixth former dishing out the vegetables and so on. Which, of course, for some kids would be the only time they would sit down and do a formal meal. Yeah. It was all part of the social education of young people, rather than everybody just cramming
into
the cafeteria.
But the government will say they simply can't afford it.
Well, I would suggest to you, if you can't afford to do sensible things like that for your young people, then you've got your priorities wrong. And this is the issue, isn't it?
I mean, we've also had 1,000 teachers cut here in Bristol, which people forget from time to time.
I mean, the thing is, this austerity thing is a complete fiction. The government can afford things that it wants to afford. So it can afford tax cuts for the wealthiest. Mm. It can afford Trident. It can afford, you know, it's been looking to afford HS2, although that might be getting unreasonable.
East Coast Main Line to
be subsidised. East Coast Main Line, and, you know, paying that off. I mean, you know, the money is there. If they want to spend money, you know, think about the tax cut they're giving the royal family to help them soup up Buck House. I mean, if they want to spend money, you know, on stuff, they can and they will. But if they actually don't want spend money, then they will starve it. They're like, they're deliberately starving the NHS. They are, you know, it's a choice, and it's, you know, it's not a question if they can't afford to provide feed these kids. They're choosing not to, which is a different ball game altogether.
Well, talking about the NHS, that really, I think, for me, is the big story of the holiday, actually. Metro reporting an accident and emergency doctor apologises for the third world conditions at his hospital. An A&E doctor said sorry to his patients for the third world conditions at my hospital. Dr Richard Fawcett, a consultant working at University Hospitals of North Midlands NHS Trust, said he was heartbroken to see so many frail and elderly patients languishing in corridors. On Twitter, he apologised to patients in the Stoke area for the third world conditions of the department due to overcrowding. Meanwhile, Royal College of Emergency Medicine and the Society for Acute Medicine both issued stark warnings over increased pressure to services. Emergency medicine consultant Dr Adrian Boyle, chairman for quality at the RCEM, said everybody is struggling at the moment. Dr Boyle said every type 1 emergency department that he knows of is under serious sustained pressure. He said it feels worse than the equivalent period last year. Well, we've also heard facts, figures, saying, Martin Summers, that it is worse.
Well, I think when you've got the senior personnel in the health service and you have saying that the situation is not acceptable and that it's worse than it has been, you've got to take that seriously. I mean, they're the people who know.
Yeah,
we've also seen one of the other things that this tweeting doctor from Stoke has been saying is that there are a lot of the money that should be going to pay nurses, pay doctors and pay staff is going to fund various changes and privatisation. It's a whole process of tendering out contracts.
Yeah, I mean, tendering out, forcing people to tender out contracts wastes an obscene amount of money, wastes an awful lot of time and energy. The point people need to realise is this government does not want the NHS to succeed. They're deliberately setting it up to fail. This crisis that we've got this winter, the crisis we had last winter, were deliberate acts on their part. I'll never forget the poster, the beginning, in the run-up to the election in 2010, you know, David Cameron, I'll cut the deficit, not the NHS. Well, the deficit has gone through the roof and the NHS is being deliberately decimated and sold off.
Well, I mean, yes, of course, David Cameron at that time promised no top-down reorganisation of the health service and then immediately brought in a top-down reorganisation.
Yep, he lied.
And we've got to get away from this idea that a little bit of private sector won't do any harm. The principle of the health service being planned from the centre means that the whole idea of having trust hospitals makes a nonsense of any kind of planning. And we've been going down this road for so long, and we had a Labour government that didn't really turn back. And we now get the situation where they're continuing to push this through. I mean, Hunter's already written a book about getting rid of the health service, and he's the health secretary. I mean, you know, Go figure.
We also had the Duke of Edinburgh saying that he didn't like the health service, which he saw as a sacred cow. Do you think it is anymore, Fabian?
I think it's essential. I think, you know, we shouldn't fetishise it, but it is essential. And countries that have proper state-provided healthcare have people, you know, don't have people going bankrupt when they're ill. In America, a lot of bankruptcies are caused because of health bills. You know, you have a child who has cancer, it's not covered by the insurance or, you know, your health insurance, and you've got to pay for it yourself, and you lose everything simply because somebody's got ill. Do we really want to go down that road? Surely it's much better for everybody, rich or poor, if we all pay our taxes and our health service is funded and provided by the state. The NHS in 1948 was the best thing Labour's ever done. And I think the reason the Tories hate it is because it's one of our big success stories.
Well, one thing the Conservatives, it's been reported in the Independent today, is that the party, his membership was plunging. Back at the time of the 2015 election, general election, I can remember having a look at it. It was around about 120,000 members. Now, apparently, it's fallen down to 70,000, but the Conservative Party won't publish the numbers of members for the last 4 years, Martin Summers.
Well, that's because they're gradually dying off, aren't they? That's the reality. Although I saw an interesting thing this week that said the average age of Labour Party members was 58 and the average age of Tory Party members was slightly older. So the idea that massive numbers of young people have tipped the balance in terms of who's a member of a political party doesn't seem to be the case. But if they're not actually selling people who's in the party, then I don't see how you can make comparisons, can you?
Well, it's the head of the Campaign for Conservative Democracy said that he'd heard that the figure had dropped to 70,000 now from 120,000. It says, in stark contrast, Labour said it now has over 550,000 members last summer. Both the Scottish National Party, which is 120,000, and the Lib Dems, 103,000, have got quite considerably more than the Conservatives, half as much again, Fabian.
It's because the Conservatives are a toxic brand and they only look after a very few
people. Well, everyone votes for them, though, don't they? Well, not everyone, but certainly they managed to get a majority last year.
Well, not a majority. They had to throw the DUP a bung of a billion to get them in. Again, another case of if they need to spend money or want to spend money, they can easily find it. Further proof of the austerity lie. Yeah, I mean, we just need to convince. We've obviously got a job of work to do to convince more people who should be trusting Labour to get behind us. We do have, you know, a lot of, you know, the BBC is now basically a propaganda machine for the Tories now. It's increasingly biased and partial in what it...
But OK, what evidence do you have for that? Because you do get Labour people on the BBC just as you get Tory people, sure.
Yeah, but you watch Question Time and, you know, as soon as a Labour person's breathes in, you know, they're being barraged with a whole load of questions, can't get a word out.
Well, you get people like Will Self on, don't you? Basically left-leaning comedians. You get some, both sides, surely.
Yeah, but you look at what isn't reported. I'll never forget, quite early on, it was after one of the first Tory conferences in Manchester after they'd won. There was a big demonstration, anti-austerity demonstration, and a complete news blackout. You only knew it was happening because of social media. And there was, you know, photos, the streets were thronging, and nothing got reported.
So do you spend more of your time looking at social media or at the mainstream news? And if it is the mainstream news, which one, you know, which newspapers
do you look at? It's a bit of both. I mean, you've obviously got to take everything with a bit of salt, but pinch of salt, because you've obviously got to be aware of fake news, and you've also got to be careful that people don't blow stuff out of all context, so there's a need to sort of check things a bit. But I tend to prefer, if I'm watching the TV news, I'll either watch Sky or I'll watch ITV.
Martin?
Well, I do most of my research on the internet, and it's not really social media. It's just
all those fake news sites you look at.
Well, it's the ones I trust that I go to, obviously, and of course I get a very wide. I get all my news through reading.
Well, whatreallyhappened.com, for example, is one of the fake news sites.
Well, no, whatreallyhappened.com has got everything on it. There's about 60 to 70 posts a day on there, and it's got everything from the far right to the far left. So that's why I go there.
And everything
in
between.
It's got everything on it.
Yeah. Okay, so...
It may not be true.
Well, but you've got to sift it.
Oh, yeah. This is the whole point. The whole point is, I think the important thing is that people have got to think for themselves and sift everything and think about, you know, anything that's reported, because it might not be...
That's right. I mean, media studies is often mocked as an A-level, but that's exactly what the key core of it is understanding how news reports are constructed, what kind of biases there might be, what kind of agendas there are behind it.
OK, well, look, getting back to Conservative Party membership plummeting, roughly we're told 70,000 now. That's, you know, gone down, certainly, 75% of what it was. If you believe their figures, one of the figures here is telling me 100,000. Gosh, it must be some fake news in there somewhere, either me and my 120,000 or them and their 100,000. If you think about it, this is really dwarfed by trade union membership, Martin, isn't it?
It is, but trade union membership is largely passive. I mean, not to say that political party membership is as always passive.
But the trade unions, people vote for a lot of their key officials, don't they? So they're saying, I want this person to...
They do, but the turnout is often low. I mean, I say that as an active trade union.
So it is in local elections. But it is in local elections.
Indeed, and the trade unions have a legitimate role, and they are representative to an extent, but it can't be exaggerated. I think what's interesting about the Labour Labour membership is it is rather active now.
Yeah.
And we've got, that's one of the things we've got that the other side haven't got. If an election is called this year, and let's hope it is, we're ready to go. I mean, all those people...
They're not going to do that again, are they?
Well, we'll see, because what may
you
happen...
You had your chance last year, and you muffed
Tony,
it.
Tony, events, dear boy, events. Things are going to change around here. It's not going to be straightforward as people think. But I think the fact about the Labour Party membership, certainly the people I know who've joined in recent years, is that they're not just passive. They want to do stuff. And the kind of ground game that we've now built up is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
And I say that as somebody, as you know, Fabian, we've both been involved in that in one way or another for many years.
Go on, Fabian.
I think we're definitely in a stronger position than we've been before on that one. You give us your bit of wishful thinking then.
Go on.
Well, I actually agree with him. I mean, at the last election, the one thing that was noticeable was that far bigger numbers on the streets campaigning for Labour. I mean, we actually, at the start of the election, we thought we could lose Bristol East, and we were really worried. And it just sort of snowballed in the right direction. I mean, the manifesto came out was fantastic in so many ways. Some brilliant stuff in there. And everyone just, Jeremy Corbyn discovered he's in a statesman, and it just mobilised and motivated everybody, and you had everyone from Momentum to Prospect to Progress piling out, campaigning together and just working together, and you know, there's a real buzz about the election. We faced absolute decimation at the start of the election. We were 20 points behind, and then we ended up taking the Tories' majority away. That's quite remarkable.
But it wasn't enough, was it?
Not quite, but we always had our backs to the wall.
Okay, Martin, is also a rather horrible story this week. I mean, there's so many, aren't there? But this one particularly stood out to me. Labour calls on the Tories to sack a council leader who demanded the homeless people be removed for the royal wedding. Simon Dudley said rough sleepers present Windsor in a sadly unfavourable light and urged police to take legal action against them using some vagrancy act from hundreds of years ago. Now, I wonder what... Harry and Meghan would make of this.
Well, I'd like to think that Prince Harry would not approve. He's trying to carve out a place for himself as a, you know, as a thinker, if you like. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I can go along
well,
with
did,
that.
He edited the Today programme, didn't he?
He did. And he's obviously, he brought Obama on, which caused some harumphing from more conservative people. And he also brought his dad on, of course, to go on about his usual hobby horses. I think, in general, I think Britain's got to ask itself what sort of are we the sort of country that at a royal wedding we're going to clear beggars off the streets? Why can't the beggars be given a flag and told to cheer along, you know, give them a cup of tea?
And if you really want to deal with homelessness and clear homeless people off the streets, house them. I mean, you know, it's not rocket science. There's thousands of empty homes across the country. They need to be, you know, the government could find money to... you know, release money to enable those to be brought back online. We're doing what we can to improve housing in Bristol. But, I mean, you know, it's a national problem. I've seen, you know, wherever you go, there's been an absolute explosion of homelessness.
But he says, hang on, just a minute. What he's saying is a large number of adults that are begging in Windsor are not, in fact, homeless. And if they are homeless, they're choosing to reject all support services to beg on the streets of Windsor. In the case of homelessness amongst this group, it's therefore a voluntary choice.
Well, have they actually got caseworkers going out, talking to them and finding out what really has gone on? Maybe people are homeless because they've had relationship breakdown, they've come out of an abusive relationship, or they've lost their job and therefore lost their home because they couldn't afford the rent or the mortgage, or they've got quite serious mental health issues and they've ended up out on, you know, find out.
He added, Martin Summers, that this is creating a concerning and hostile atmosphere for our residents and the 7 million tourists who will come to Windsor each year. It's becoming increasingly concerning. See, the quantities of bags and detritus that those begging are accumulating and leaving on our pavements, at times unattended, presenting a security risk. So there could be bombs in there.
Well, indeed. But I think if the posh people of Windsor are getting a bit fed up of tripping over homeless people, they might like to think about their ballot box and where they put their vote.
Mm.
Because we know that since this government came to power, there's been a massive increase in homelessness directly as a result of universal credit, which private landlords will not accept as a rent payment. And these private landlords are all Tory voters as well.
Not all private landlords.
Not all of them, but many of them. And of course, at the same time, they've made it clear. I mean, this is why
if you know any private landlords that aren't, I'd be very interested to get them in to talk, because that almost seems like the landlords' party, the Tory party.
Well, I went a couple of places out. Had some inheritance that came through. And I work on the basis, one, I try to make sure, you know, I work on the basis that if you wouldn't be prepared to live in it yourself, you shouldn't let it out. So I always do my best to make sure everything's okay, and if things need fixing, I get it fixed. And, you know, I make sure the places are, you know, it's only a couple of places, it's just a bit of inheritance I got bought.
Would you accept as a landlord somebody on universal credit? Because many landlords won't. I mean, if you go to an agency and say, I'd like to rent someone there, they say, are you on universal credit? And if you say yes, they'll say, well, forget it. And I've had that experience.
I'd have to look into it and have to, certainly if I had somebody, you know, who a sitting tenant who lost their job and then found themselves in universal credit, I certainly wouldn't turf them out.
Well, I think there are big buy-to-let landlords in the southeast of England who said when universal credit was first brought forward, they said it's quite straightforward. We are not going to rent to people on universal credit, and our existing tenants, as they're put onto universal credit, we're going to evict.
It sounds to me
and
what you're saying.
That's why there's been a massive increase in homelessness.
Yeah, what you're saying, Fabian, is you wouldn't let someone rent one of your properties.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Came to you and they were on universal credit then.
I'd have to find out more about what was involved. I mean, because, you know, I just have to deal with it as it came.
Well, the thing is that it's not enough money, and you've got to have the weights and all the rest of it. So for many people who rent out who are quite well-intentioned, it's just not worth the risk. And they've known this all along with Universal Credit. They could change the admin rule and say that they'd pay landlords directly. That would make a big difference.
Because
then you'd know the money was guaranteed.
Yes.
So because of part of the social engineering side of it that Ian Duncan Smith pushed, they've all got to manage their own money, even if they've got mental health issues, drug addiction, whatever, then the playing safe, landlords just going to say, well, we don't want people on universal credit.
I mean, we ought to be thinking about something more radical like a universal basic income, and then tackle poverty big time and
well, the thing about problems. Universal credit is that it in principle is an embryo for doing that, if you took away all of the social engineering aspects of it, trying to make people, you know, better citizens, so that they can all go to heaven because they've saved their money properly and all the rest of it.
This is going to be introduced fairly soon, isn't it? But I noticed
they're finding it really difficult, Tony, because of these practical problems.
They're introducing it in Northern Ireland, which is always a bit of a dodgy place to introduce these things. But the key part of universal credit benefit for the whole country has quietly closed. What it could mean for you, says the Mirror. The flagship reforms live service has been closed to all new claimants, and that was just effective from New Year's Day. So a key part of the all-in-one benefit, Universal Credit, has been quietly wound down. The flagship reforms live service was closed on New Year's Day. It doesn't mean the rollout of the controversial benefits has been stopped, far from it, but it does mean people will take longer to join it. The Department for Work and Pensions insists it was always part of the plan to take this week's move, but its timing's been moved, and Labour says the change, dictated by job centres in an urgent bulletin on the 14th of December, so it shows the chaos in Universal Credit. So it's going to actually make it more difficult for people to join. This live service they've shut is an in-between form of universal credit that enrolled mainly people with simple cases, such as single childless job seekers, and they were able to enrol a little bit early.
Well, that's right. I mean, I was on it a couple of years ago, and I've been through the system. And the problem with it is this. I think the fundamental problem, as I've just mentioned, is that they won't pay landlords directly, which housing benefit used to be the case, that landlords could be paid directly. And therefore, on that basis, landlords are prepared to take on tenants who are on housing benefit or universal credit.
But one of the interesting things about shutting down this live version that it means that these people will have to go onto what they call legacy benefits, like housing benefit and job seekers allowance.
So, in other words, they've put them all on universal credit, and now they're going to have to take them off again because they can't make it work.
This is for new people. Will not be going onto universal credit. They'll be going onto job seekers allowance and housing benefit.
This thing should have been rolled out years ago, and it hasn't been rolled out because it's badly designed. And it's fundamentally, I mean, what's the bad design in it is Ian Duncan Smith's social engineering goals, which is, you know, if you took all of that attempt to try and make people better out of it and just treated it as a benefit, then you could probably make it work. But the reason why the benefit system evolved in the way it did is through various bodges as we go along. I mean, that's people who work in the civil service will know that things end up being as they are because of the various decisions that you take, and you can say, "Well, we're going to take a broom to all of that and start afresh." But often there is a reason why things are as they are. You can't just start afresh, and often tinkering is better than attempting to do something ambitious, especially if it's misconceived.
Well, look, let's get back to the health service, because for me that's been the big story over the last couple of weeks. Nearly 17,000 patients we've just heard today on the Independent website. Waiting more than half an hour in ambulances. I mean, this is just getting appalling. Another headline, the NHS is extending suspension of all non-urgent care as doctors warn of a winter crisis. They reckon there'll be 55,000 deferred operations and 17,000 people waiting in ambulances outside hospitals, Fabian.
Well, it's deliberate. It is deliberate, pre-planned underfunding of the NHS. Make it fail, cause it to fail, and then use that as an excuse to privatise it. It's a known process if you want to sell something off. And if this is being deliberately done, and this government have got blood on their hands because this is costing people their lives, and it's leaving people in pain unnecessarily. It's all avoidable.
Martin Summers, routine hospital appointments are to be delayed to free up capacity for the sickest patients until the end of January. Warnings of extreme pressure facing A&Es across the country. The NHS has taken the drastic step of extending the cancellation of non-urgent operations to include thousands more minor procedures this month. Amid multiple reports of NHS services struggling to cope this Christmas, as I said before, officials estimated 55,000 deferred operations.
Well, I mean, I'll just reiterate what Fabian said there. I think there is an element of deliberate strategy here. They're trying to make it look as if it's failing so that they can privatise it. But I wonder whether that's going to work, given the role of the National Health Service in Britain's national life and self-perception and so on. I don't think it... I mean, Jeremy Hunt, as I say, has written a book about getting rid of the health service. And, of course, what he now says, that was when I was younger, I don't think like that anymore. But you've got to think, you've got to imagine, well, if you've written a book about getting rid of the health service, and, you know, then you end up being the health secretary, the question's got to be, well, surely that's what you believe, isn't it?
And also you've got to look at the drip-drip feed of it's not sustainable that's being, you know, that we're getting on the mainstream news.
OK, where are we going to find the money for this for? Because there's money simply not there anymore.
That's not true.
It isn't. I mean, you know,
close tax loopholes, tax people fairly.
There's no magic money tree.
There isn't a magic money tree. It's called quantitative easing, Tony. And we've been using it for years. And after the Brexit vote, we had a great big dollop of it. But most people have forgotten about that. There was a great big dollop of quantitative easing for the banks. And the theory is that we're going to get all that money back. But we're not, of course. It's all just gone down the drain. People are beginning to see through. The austerity agenda was almost like a kind of morality story. If we tighten our belts a bit, eventually things will get better. But of course, as you pointed out earlier, Fabian, they've cut taxes for the wealthiest. Now, hang on, if we've got to get the deficit down, where does that fit in?
Yeah, sure.
It doesn't make any sense at all, does it?
If you've got to get the deficit down, you should increase taxes for the wealthiest, clear as much as you can, and then come back to the rest of the population and say, okay, we managed to clear 80% of it. We've still got 20% left.
Yeah.
How do we want to settle it? Do you want to pay higher taxes, or do you want to have cuts, or do you want a bit of both?
Yeah, the thing is about the Tories is that their backers want tax cuts.
Yeah.
And they have to promise their backers tax cuts, even as they're telling the rest of us there's no money for X, Y, and Z. And of course,
what's happening in America.
The people that voted for them are their backers.
No, the people that voted for them, not necessarily... The people that voted for their backers, but they also... But you just mentioned how they've got very few members and so on. They're very much dependent upon spending lots of money in elections.
Yeah.
That's what they do. and their backers demand, you know, demand certain things. They want tax cuts. Now, if the Tory party was tacking to the left, as it ought to be doing, they would be telling their backers, look, you just have to swallow it. You know, we're not decreasing taxes for the wealthy until the deficit's got rid of. We can't. But, of course, they've tried to. They've not done that. They've done exactly the opposite. And, of course, ordinary people can see through that. When you say there's no money for the health service, there's no money for this, but there's money for tax cuts. Can't be money for tax cuts when the deficit's still there.
I mean, how it works in Spain... How it works in Spain is that big government contracts that are awarded, they get bungs to the main political party, the People's Party, Rajoy's party, and that money is stashed in Switzerland, hundreds of thousands of euros sitting there for them to then fight the next election. Does that happen here?
Well, yeah, to some extent it does. I mean, there's 17.5 million given to the Tory party to fight the 1992 election, and, you know, we've got various sources of information where that came from. That was an awful lot of money.
And where did it come from? Verify it?
General Wild Boar Smith brought the check to Tory central office.
Kenneth Warren, wasn't it?
From Jersey. Yes, well, Doug Hoyle, the MP, Labour MP, asked a question in the House of Commons about where the money had come from, and they flim-flammed. We suspect it may have been to do with illegal nuclear weapons being sold, but that's another story.
I mean,
is that this huge amounts of money are involved in elections, and, of course, those who provide that money then expect a payoff.
OK, well, locally, Bristol City Council faces a £7 million tax deficit. Council's looking to save £108 million by 2023. The 6.6 million deficit is largely due to appeals arising from business rates, which total a whopping £14 million. A relatively small £194,000 of the deficit is on overestimation of council tax receipts. It looks as if Bristol businesses are fighting like crazy not to pay their business rates, Fabian.
It looks like it. I mean, obviously, they've obviously got to...
There's no personal liability. Sorry to interrupt. There's no personal liability for a business owner who uses a bit of their profits to pay a lawyer to say, well, look, we don't really want to pay this. What I'm saying is they don't have to pay anything themselves, and then they can write that lawyer off against tax. They don't have to pay tax on that money, do they? So it seems to me as if you're a business, you may as well pay a lawyer to see if they can get you off the tax.
Possibly, and some do. I mean, the problem is all these tax loopholes. The tax system is overcomplicated, and it's got loads of loopholes. And you know, you get a lawyer in. If you're dealing with enough money, then it's worth getting a lawyer in. And
£6.5 million.
But that doesn't make it right. I mean, I've just paid my tax bill for the last financial year. You know, most of us do, and we all should. But for some people, in dealing with large businesses and large sums of money, they pay lawyers.
Is that a business rate or what? What sort of bill are you talking about there? Your personal tax or what?
Personal tax, yeah.
Martin, what do you make of this? £6.5 million not being paid by Bristol businesses. They're appealing against decisions. I suppose they've got a right to do that, haven't they?
Yeah, and they may fail. So it's not, you know, but I mean, the problem is that we all know that money's tight. I think the whole basis of local authority funding needs to be looked at. And if we get a change of government, perhaps it should be looked at. In Northern Ireland, they still have the rating system. They didn't dare to bring in the poll tax there or community charge. And of course, that makes Northern Ireland local government much better funded than on this side of the water.
We should go back to rates. I mean, the council tax is a nonsense.
Yeah, chasing people for small amounts of money is a really silly.
Well,
system.
It's not about small amounts of money. It's chasing people that don't have any money.
Well, exactly. And that's not very efficient from the council's point of view, is it?
No, it isn't. Anyway, no Prime Minister's questions. Martin will be happy mercifully about that this week. But there was one just before Christmas which we didn't have a listen to, and that was Conservative criticism of the Shadow Chancellor John McDonnell, who seems to think he's got a magic money tree.
Nadeem Zahawi.
Speaker, does the First Secretary agree with me that we don't need to break into the computer or the iPad of the member for Hayes and Harlington to work out that half a trillion that he wants to borrow will attract £7.5 billion of interest payments every year?
Well, the one difficulty with that otherwise ingenious question is that it bears no relation to government policy, for which the Right Honourable Gentleman is responsible, but rather to that of the Shadow Chancellor, for which he isn't.
Ah, so it wasn't actually, there was, the Prime Minister didn't even have to answer it. But the question itself is worth asking, isn't it? I mean, you know, trillions of pounds that that John McDonnell wants to borrow, Martin, there's going to be massive interest payments on that. And also, we seem to be getting maybe to the end of the time where we're having very low interest rates.
Well, that's the point I was going to make. Interest rates are, in fact, quite low. So the idea that if you were going to borrow money, this, you know, that when interest rates are low is the time to do it. But of course, any business that's talking about investing, they've got to look at what they're going to spend it on. Is it going to have a rate of return higher than the rate of interest? Mm. And of course, if John McDonnell spends the stuff on improving infrastructure and so on and so forth, which has got a rate of return on it, then it's perfectly rational to do so, yeah, provided the rate of return is higher than the projected rate of interest. That's how all business is done. And what the Tories are just don't like, they don't like the government taking the initiative. They want to leave it all up to the private sector, which doesn't want to invest because there's no demand in the economy.
Yeah, basically that's it. I mean, there's not much more I can add to that. I mean, but we do have, you know, massive underinvestment. You know, local government is being cut, and if the cuts on local government continue, we won't even have the money to cover adult social care and children's services, never mind, you know, street lighting, bin collections, libraries,
undergrounds, arenas, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, we shall see.
What's happening with the arena, Fabian? What's the latest?
I understand decisions being made about the location this month. Personally, I think we should go for, it should stay at Temple Meads. My personal conviction is if it's there in the city centre, it will be in a similar location to the one in Newcastle, where that's right by their central station, so it'd be right by ours. I think if we move it to Filton, even if it's a slightly cheaper option, there's a risk that all the money and the benefit and the actual spending for, you know, hotels, shopping and stuff like that, and restaurants will end up going to Cribbs Causeway in South Gloucestershire and won't benefit the Bristol.
Is it definitely going to happen, the arena now?
I hope so. I think that the issue for me, I want it to happen and I'll back making it happen. I think the issue for me is Bristol needs to prove it can build big projects, because so many things have been planned and been sabotaged in the
sabotaged?
Past.
Sabotaged? Like what?
Well,
that's a very strong word to use, Fabian, isn't it?
Sabotage. Okay, the last time there was a tram system that was mooted, it was going to end at Almsbury, I think, and then right at the last minute, when it was too late to do anything, certain individuals in power in South Gloucestershire insisted on the route being diverted to Cribbs Causeway. And had they mentioned that, said that right from the start, it wouldn't have been an issue. But because they said it right at the last minute, it was too late, and the whole thing collapsed because there just wasn't the money to redo all the work that, you know. So things like that are, you know, don't
frustrating.
Help.
Yeah. Anyway, one of the big national infrastructure projects, we've just had Lord Adonis resign from the committee that runs infrastructure, mm-hmm. Which I was not surprised at, having seen some of the problems that are going on with his pet project HS2, which seems to be hitting the buffers before even the first sleeper has been laid for it. And I had a chat to a former civil engineer, transport and land use planner. He's retired, and he's had spent quite a lot of his retirement doing freedom of information requests on HS2. And his name is John Marriott. And I spoke to him on Wednesday evening this week, and here's what he has to say about the project.
One of the things that I was trying to get them to admit was the fact that speed and capacity were related, such that when you went fast, capacity went down. They failed to produce anything that supports their claim, which is not surprising because it's wrong. On the forecasts, they refuse to produce any forecast because they claim it's commercially sensitive. But Network Rail, back in 2013, produced some estimates of what they thought the forecast would be between various cities. And if you compare those forecasts with the sort of number of trains that HS2 are proposing, you find that some trains are very empty, particularly something, say, like Birmingham to Manchester, where the flow is something like about 1,000 people per day, and they're proposing something like 17,000 seats a day, two trains an hour, which is huge overcapacity. And the train between Birmingham and Manchester can only stop at a station near Birmingham Airport if it gets built, but that's not currently part of the current scheme and not included in the costs. One of the things that HS2 does is when it gets to a bend, instead of being able to use the bend that was on the original Great Central Railway line, they're proposing to straighten it out because the speed, they're trying to design it for 400 kilometres an hour, 250 miles an hour, which requires bends with a radius of over 9 kilometres. Whereas once you get the speed down to something more sensible, and in fact 250 kilometres per hour, 150 mile an hour, is regarded by the International Union of Railways as a high-speed line. So instead of going for 150, HS2 are trying to go for 250 miles an hour. That, say, not only makes the line expensive because it has to be straight and it can't miss anything, it knocks loads of things down, but it also puts the costs up. And in fact, there are no 250 mile an hour trains around. And although they're saying it's future-proof for that, the power supplies aren't up to driving trains at that sort of speed. What they tried to claim originally when they said they decided they wanted a new line was that it only costs 9% more to go at 250 miles an hour than it did to go at 125. Now, the basis for that estimate was completely flawed because they just made wild guesses about how much extra it would cost to go at double the speed. And when you look at what they included in that estimate, it was completely fictitious and bogus. You can see from the costs that are coming out that the true cost of going like double the speed is probably double.
Well, that's incredible, really, isn't it, that they didn't seem to have any idea about the lack of capacity that's caused by trying to go so fast on these trains, because they will then take several miles to stop if they're going 250 miles an hour. The publicfinance.co.uk site has had a story over Christmas where they're saying that it's 18th of December, this, high-speed rail HS2 lacks basic financial controls, that £1.76 million of unauthorised payments could have been avoided with tighter financial controls. Public Accounts Committee has said that they don't have any basic financial controls, and they're also being very secretive, Fabian.
Yeah, I mean, what I find offensive is that, you know, money's being thrown at this, and as the speaker you've just had has said, you know, it's all wild guesses, and yet the funding for, you know, they've axed the funding for a direct electric rail service electrification to Bristol Temple Meet, you know, so we're going to have to put up with, you know, the electric service will stop at Chippenham, and we'll have to have hybrid trains. Sorry, there was a knock on the window, that's why I paused. We'll have to have hybrid trains, you know, and it's a real insult. You know, they can spend money on this, demolish everything.
Let's just run through the things. Not even give us a direct electric rail service to London from Bristol. Let me just summarise what John Marriott was saying there. He's saying that the forecasts are all wrong, that the Birmingham to Manchester part of HS2, it looks as if it will be only 1 in 17 seats will actually be filled on that train from Birmingham to Manchester. So, I mean, imagine that during non-peak hours. You're talking about possibly entire carriages empty. So they haven't actually done their figures properly on the demand for it.
It's grotesque.
They're building stations out of the city centres, exactly opposite of what we were thinking about Temple Meads there and interchanges like that. And also that they're building this thing for 250 mile an hour trains that don't exist. And then they're saying, oh, well, they will by the time it's finished. And then they're building in the power transformers and stuff at a lower power than that could drive trains at 250 miles an hour, Martin. It just looks as if this like Hinkley Point is some sort of enormous project that's just been, various government people have just signed up to it, and they haven't really even had a proper look.
Well, I think the other thing is the conception of it is that if you've got a faster train between London and Birmingham, that's going to help Birmingham. But what can happen with these things is that you actually suck. It just means it's faster for resources to be sucked to London from Birmingham. So it doesn't actually work in the way you think it's going to work. And in any case, if you're going to do infrastructure, it makes sense to my mind to do lots of small things, moderate-sized projects, whereas if you get it wrong, you've got it wrong, but you've not bet bet the farm on it. And, you know, the obvious thing to do is to try, is to create linkages, for example, between Manchester and Leeds. That's the sort of thing I would look at doing, rather than putting everything into London. You know, if you want to build up infrastructure, the obvious place to do it is actually in the peripheral regions which lack
infrastructure. The costs are also exploded with HS2. One independent transport campaigner before Christmas said that the cost is up to £111 billion. Is this ever going to happen, Martin, do you think?
Well, it may be. The problem with these big projects like Hinkley and like HS2 is once you've spent millions and millions of pounds on getting the whole thing going, you then get path dependent on it. If you decide to cancel it, you're going to end up losing all the money you've already spent on it. So this is Milton Friedman's argument against government intervention in general, is that the problem is that you just end up spending more than you intended, and you can't back out of it, and then they keep coming back for more.
Sometimes you need to accept that you've got to stop throwing good money after bad.
Well, you do, but I mean, obviously there's a tendency for that to be a very difficult decision to make, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, and also it's worth pointing out that HS2 does absolutely nothing for Bristol. If anything, if it's a success, shall we say, it will simply take all the energy, you know, London, Birmingham and the North, and we'll just be completely forgotten on at the other end of the M4.
Finally, Toby Young, there's an interesting article in The Guardian I was looking at the other day, which shows some of the tweets. He's just been appointed to run the university's watchdog, that he's been doing all sorts of eugenics tweets, and also on eugenics with related to working class people and breasts. The Guardian says, Toby Young quotes on breasts, eugenics and working class people, the key quotes and tweets behind the backlash against the ex-journalist's appointment to the new university watchdog. It was announced on the 1st of January. He's in a 2015 essay for the Australian publication The Quadrant, entitled The Fall of the Meritocracy. Under a section headed Progressive Eugenics, Young proposed that poorer people should be helped to choose which embryos were allowed to develop based on their intelligence. My proposal is this: once the technology, genetically engineered intelligence, becomes available, why not offer it free of charge to parents on low incomes or below average IQs, provided there is sufficient take-up? It could help to address the problem of flatlining intergenerational social immobility. Martin.
Well, it's rather offensive stuff, isn't it? And of course, Toby Young is essentially a controversialist and a provocateur. And do we need a university's watchdog? We haven't had one before. We've got one. He's been given a job for the boys on that watchdog. Nobody from the students, no students are represented on it. Nobody who works in the university sector is represented on it. It's basically a creation by the Tories to beat universities over the head, with Toby Young as one of their little protégés to lead it. But of course, he got his place in Oxford University because his father, Michael Young, phoned up the tutor at Brasenose, even though he got no qualifications adequate to getting a place, and he got a place.
He actually left school at 16 with a 1-0 level, didn't he?
Yes, but his dad was Michael Young, who was a famous Labour activist and peer, I believe. And of course, he then phoned up and he got a place at Oxford on the back of a phone call from his dad.
Yeah,
you did
Whereas
the same
I
course
had
as him.
O levels, A levels, and then I got to Polytechnic because my grades were.
Martin, you did the same courses in PPE, didn't you? This is one that quite often people are kind of tapped on the shoulder to do
a
PPE.
No, well, I mean, all sorts of different people do it. The point is that he didn't go in through the front door. He went in through the back door through his dad's connections. And of course, his dad was Labour, and therefore, you could say, "Well, that's terrible." But of course, the point is, he shouldn't really. This organisation shouldn't necessarily exist, and he shouldn't necessarily be running.
Anyway, I'll put a link to all of these revolting tweets of this horrific man that's been put in charge of looking after our universities on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. And tributes have been paid this week to Steve Norman, Bristol's what the Bristol Post calls Bristol's well-known, relentless and loudest activist. Steve always fought for the underdog, the poor, the homeless and the working class, a true hero and inspiration to many. He's from Shirehampton. He dedicated his life campaigning on a huge range of issues, from the pollution of companies in Avonmouth, the sell-off of council homes, with a barbed wit and an eye-catching stunt. Of course, he's been on this programme too, and I'm joined by one of his close colleagues, John Langley. Hi, John. Welcome to the Politics Show. Just tell us a bit about your impressions of Steve.
Oh, dear. Where do I start? We're still pretty much getting over the shock of his death, and he was a real working class guy with a massive, massive heart, and the compassion for, if you like, the underdog, really. And, you know, he championed causes and brought attention, you know, to causes that otherwise wouldn't have sort of seen the light of day. You know, he was very much, I think, what you might call a Marmite man. You know, there are times when he loved him, but probably in times when people hated him. But there was a very kind soul there, a very, very warm, very generous man who, you know, would give up his last penny to help another person, really. And, you know, that's the memory that I will always have of him anyway.
He had this very strong sense of justice and injustice, didn't he? And I think that's one of the things I'd say about Steve. If he thought there was an injustice being done, he saw it as his job to do something about it. And maybe this came from his Merchant Navy training and his work on ships, because when you're with people on a ship, you know, things can go wrong, and you really do need to rely on those around you, and you have this sense of camaraderie, which he almost seemed to have for everyone in the city.
He did. I mean, he was... I have to say, you know, since his passing, it's been all over the country, you know, and in some cases, in parts of the world. So his name has gone far and wide, and that's, I think, what's shocked a lot of us, just how far his name travelled, and that just goes to show the sort of guy that he was, you know.
Well, we may well be putting out some details of funeral details and that sort of thing. But I think we have to finish by saying something about his work with the homeless, because this, I think, was one of the things that I saw him on the front line, literally making sure people had somewhere to live who didn't. I mean, that to me was one of the most incredible. You know, for anybody to say, OK, so you haven't got a home, I'll find you one, is an incredible thing to do.
It was, and even if it was just temporary shelter, by way of a caravan or a tent, whatever he could do to enable people to have a more comfortable living from the conditions that they were in, then he would endeavour to make sure that happened. And that will continue, you know, with Homes for All and BAM. That work will continue, and, you know, his memory and everything about him will live on. I think that's all I can say, really.
I'd also ask you to say, do you have any sort of abiding memory of first meeting Steve and first coming across him, and something that made you think, well, crikey, who's this guy?
Yeah, when I first was a candidate, and I think that was for Stockwood, and Steve came to the hustings, and he was very full on, you know, sort of very...
Asking you questions.
Yeah, and very loud. Extremely loud. Yeah, he struck me then as being somebody who was who had the heart of people in mind all of the time. And
Fabian, have you got any memories of Steve?
He was a very regular attender in the public gallery at full council.
Vociferous, loud.
Yeah, but I suppose the question with the amount of protests and all of that we get is how do we get better conversations between, you know, the discontented and the council, and give the council a kinder face.
Let's see if we can't do something about that in memory of Steve anyway. Time now for the Murdoch News at 6. See you after the news.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.